road. So, Michael Madsen, thanks so much for speaking with us today at SlashFilm.com.
My pleasure.
So, I guess a lot of people, our listeners, are movie fans primarily, and they probably know you from your movie work. Can you tell us about how you first discovered your love for poetry?
Well, you know, I couldn't say that I intentionally set out to write any books. I was more of a social observance, you know? I noticed a lot of things because I'm a film actor. You become kind of hypersensitive to everybody else's mood and everybody else's gestures or the way someone walks or the way they say something or the way people relate to each other, circumstances, you know, and I kind of became like a student of human behavior. Sometimes it wasn't always good to be able to know what's going on with other people, you know, you kind of turn into some kind of a quasi-empath, you know, and I felt the need to write it down or to get stuff out on paper once in a while. And I had a bunch of it put together, and I ended up, you know, having it put into a book form. And I tried to study other poets, and I liked, I read a lot of Kerouac, and I really liked E.E. Cummings, and I liked very much Lauren Isley. He wrote a book called A Star Thrower that just blew me away. It just really, it was so kind of deep without being corny, you know. But I would say that probably Charlie Bukowski, if anything he did was he kind of made me realize that, you know, you can pretty much write about anything. You know, I didn't have that license before that. I thought I had to make everything lyrically correct, and roses are red and violets are blue, and Ho Chi Minh, go fuck you. You know what I mean? But it really,
right.
He kind of let me know that you can write about the back of that couch you're sitting on. You know. It was just kind of freed me up as
and in terms of like the form of your poems too, right? You favor some free form poetry?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the thing about Kerouac is amazing is that his stuff is almost like a run-on sentence.
Right.
The whole thing from beginning to end is like, and I wonder who put the what do you call it? Periods and commas.
Punctuation.
I wonder who put all the punctuation in there. Because I always wanted to see you know, that manuscript that he made. And because it's written on a roll of paper. And the whole thing is all just goes on and on and on.
Right.
It's not all split up into paragraphs and sentences and things like that. And I kind of wonder how much of punctuation happened in the publishing process as opposed to what he might have actually done. And so I don't have a lot of punctuation in my things because
right.
I tend to think linear. You know, if I have a run-on thought usually, and I don't know anybody else really now who's doing that except me.
You know, I was thinking about your book. The title of it is American Badass. It's on shelves now. And I was thinking, like, when I think of characters that you've played in the past, like, it seems like a really apt title. You know, a lot of times you play,
it's
like...
disturbing.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about that, right? A lot of times you play the badass, the guy with the swagger that kind of gets things done. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, what is your relationship with the roles that you've played? Because you just said it's disturbing, right?
The Charlie Bukowski book right there. I can see it through the crack in the wall. That's really crazy. and a whole bunch of. I think I. You know, I didn't really set out to be playing villainous characters. I think that Reservoir Dogs kind of put me in a category of villains in film, which I'm okay with because, you know, you look at Richard Widmark or Humphrey Bogart or Edward G. Robinson and a lot of those guys, George Raft, all those fellas, you know, they did a lot with that. But I was more thinking about Bob Mitchum or even Gregory Peck, you know, or Kirk Douglas. I mean, those guys are a lot better looking than me, so I guess, you know, they had more of a variety of roles. But I've always kind of felt like a bad guy, like a leading man, but I'm trapped in a bad guy's body. You know what I mean? It's like I don't intentionally try to give off the vibe necessarily of but I understood the characters I played. Intellectually, I understood them, but at the same time, I realized that a lot of them are very brutish and very without any remorse or mercy. And if I tried to do anything, it was that I tried to bring a remorse or mercy to the portrayal, so that it wasn't just an empty kind of thing, you know?
I think I
did that best in Kill Bill.
Right.
Unconsciously. And I don't even think Quentin necessarily wanted me to do that for Bud.
Right.
But it came out that way.
Yeah, I felt it, definitely. Great performance, by the way. I want to ask you about, I was reading about the author section, and there's this story about Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And how, you know, one of the most sort of famous scenes in modern cinema is the scene when you cut off that officer's ear in the film. And there's a story about how you were really troubled by that scene. Like, you had a hard time getting through it, especially with the officer actor ad-libbing that he had a child and a wife or something like that. Is any of that true, or can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that when you work with somebody like Quentin, he has a tremendous ability to let you improvise, bring your own thought process into the portrayal, especially back then when he was starting out, as I was too. And we rehearsed that whole movie from beginning to end, except for the ear scene, because I never really knew what the hell I was going to do. And I didn't want to think about it because I didn't want to overthink it.
Right.
I mean, in the script, I think it said, Mr. Blonde maniacally dances around the manacled cop. You know, he's handcuffed or something, which ended up being duct tape. And then, you know, I'm not a dancer, right? So, you know, I was like, what am I going to do? You know, because I didn't want to plan it. I wanted to wait until we were shooting it and then be kind of forced into whatever it is that I was going to do. Because I'm good under pressure, you know?
Right.
But it was encouraging us to improv the whole thing. And in the process of doing that, you know, I was ready to light him up. And
for real?
Yeah. And I even kind of thought, if you think that scene is horrific the way it is, can you imagine if I'd have lit him up and then got shot while he was burning up in the background? Well, I got shot during that. Oh my God. I mean, that would be hellaciously insane and very disturbing.
Was that ever an option? Or
I suggested it. But he was, he didn't go for that. He didn't want to do that. And it's his movie, and he wrote it. But, you know, I kind of was thinking in my head, listen, buddy, if you really want to go there, you want to go downtown, well, then, you know what, I'll tell you. I'll show you how to do it, okay? You really want to disturb people? You know, okay. But I guess in the long run, maybe, I know that we did four different versions of the actual ear deal. And the one where the camera pans away from Kirk and you just, Kirk Baltz is the cop, yeah. Who's a great actor, by the way.
Yeah.
And incredibly brave to do that part. And I've made some jokes about him in the past that I regret because he was a pretty solid guy to play that part. And the one where it goes away from him is the one that's in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's especially effective because you don't actually see it. You hear it. And the next thing you know is I step in frame with the ear in my hand, right?
Right.
And in reality, when we shot that, there was no rehearsal for it. I knew where the camera was. I knew that I was going to step in the frame. I knew how much space I had. And I had the fucking thing in my hand. And I walked in. And I had it. You know, and I was thinking in my head, what am I going to do with this thing now that I've cut it off? And, you know, Quentin was over by the camera. He was saying, toss it. Throw it. Throw it. Michael, throw it. Throw it. Throw it away. But I didn't want to, I was trying to think of something else to do.
Right.
And I was looking at it, and I thought, Jesus, it's an ear, right? So I went, hey, when I spoke into it, because it just seemed like, it was an ear. It
seemed like the right thing to do.
Hearing, you know, you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It seemed like something you would do if you had it, someone's ear in your hand.
If you had someone's ear in your hand, yeah.
If you wanted to really fuck with that person really badly, you would do that, right?
Yes.
As horrible as it sounds, I mean, you know, but I don't think he ever gave me credit for making that up. Obviously, you know, at the time we did it, afterwards, he thought it was funny. I remember he laughed about it. And, like 2 days later, he came up to me and said, oh, you know what? I've been looking at that footage, you know, from, you know, when you talk in the ear, and I go, yeah. He goes, it's in the movie. We're going to leave it in the movie. In other words, at the time, he probably thought I was fooling around.
Right.
And it was all, oh, that's this, you know.
But you were actually making a decision. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because he gave me the freedom to do that, but then later, you know, accepted the credit for it. I don't say that disarmingly because I respect and love Quentin. Not only is he a great filmmaker, he's also a very dear friend of mine. Getting back to the Kirk thing, we were improv-ing. And he needed something as an actor who was about to be set on fire and being tortured. He needed something to come back at me with. And he started going on and on about having a family and having kids. And that fucked me all up. You know, I was like, oh, no. Don't say that. Because if you're going to say that shit, I'm not going to chop your ear off and I'm not going to set you on fire and I'm not going to do anything to you because intellectually, as a man, as a human being, I couldn't get around that.
Right.
I could imagine being the guy who was in prison and having hatred towards the law. I could play that.
Right. But you couldn't kill, like, a father or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what messed me. I didn't like it at all.
Now, do you find that you kind of immerse yourself into your roles to that degree in general, or was that a particular case?
I think back then I did, because I was very idealistic and I was very kind of centered, and I thought that was my job to investigate those things. But, you know, over the years and since then, I've realized that basically most of the time when you're in a movie, you're a puppet, and the puppeteers will ultimately decide how the picture's going to be cut or what you did is going to be in it or not in it. And I kind of lost my, not my respect for filmmaking, but I lost my need to make sense of it, because I realized that most of it, 90% of the time, is a frivolous thing to do, which is hard to say about my craft, but I think it's been diminished over the years by so many bad actors and such lousy filmmaking that it's rare for me nowadays to embrace something.
So who are the remaining few that you really respect and admire these days?
Actor-wise,
director-wise?
Well, I never lost my respect for Quentin, obviously.
There you go.
David Carradine.
I was going to ask, I believe the book is dedicated to him, is
yeah,
that correct?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your relationship?
Well, you know, oh, God, I don't know if you have enough time.
Oh, yeah, I know you got to do your thing.
No, it's not that. It's just that I respected him and loved him so very, very much that I don't want to trivialize it. But I would say that he, the first time I met him, I had one day on an independent movie, and I only had one scene with him. And I never saw him again until 15 years later on Kill Bill.
Right.
And he was amazing. He was, there's not many Davids running around in the world. I mean, he truly was gifted, great. There's not a lot of things I could say that are, I miss him a lot. I miss him tremendously. And the last thing he told me was to never buy something from someone who's out of breath. Right. I thought that was really good advice.
That's good advice.
You know, so maybe I should just end it right now.
Yeah, let's end it right there. Well, your book, American Badass, is available for people to purchase on Amazon, right? And wherever books are sold. We're at the Trident Bookstore in Boston on Newbury Street. Michael Madsen, thanks so much for speaking with us today at SlashFilm.com.
My pleasure.
It's an honor meeting you.
God bless you.
Sorry, I didn't